Case number 19-2252 and cross appeal case number 19-2262, UAW International et al. Versus TRW Automotive US LLC. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Broski, you may proceed for the appellant cross appellee.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dale Broski. I represent the appellate TRW US LLC, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the district court's award of post-arbitration attorney fees really has two fundamental errors. The first is that the district court found that it had the authority to decide the very ERISA claims it previously compelled to binding arbitration, and then to award attorney fees for those same claims. The second error is that the district court disregarded the pay your own fee provision in section 4.4 of the controlling collective bargaining agreement that applied to all disputes arising from the CBA, which the district court already concluded included the ERISA claims. And these two issues are also two fundamental reasons why the district court was correct, albeit not for these reasons, in denying the attorney fees that were incurred at and prior to the arbitration. Now, it's well settled in this court that when it comes to arbitral labor disputes, district courts essentially have one function, and that is, absent a timely motion to vacate or modify, district court is to put the authority of the government behind an arbitration award and enforce it. District courts cannot decide the merits of arbitral labor disputes or award relief that the arbitrator does not. And in this case, over plaintiff's objection, all the plaintiff's claims were compelled to binding arbitration, including their ERISA claims.
So what's your evidence that everything was supposed to go to arbitration, including the ERISA claim?
The district court's order compelling arbitration. The district court went into detail, said there's three claims that plaintiffs are asserting, went through the breach of the CBA claim and the two ERISA claims, and said, since all the claims are arising from the CBA, all the claims have to go to binding arbitration.
Forgive me for not knowing the details, but was the gist of the ERISA claim that the company had violated the CBA? I mean, was it a...
Absolutely, Judge Sutton. It was that because the company put in a new HRA healthcare structure, as opposed to the Blue Cross Blue Shield health structure in the CBA, the plaintiffs are saying, hey, that violates the CBA. And also because in this circuit, a violation of a CBA with respect to collectively bargained insurance rights is also a violation of ERISA. All these claims spring from the CBA, and therefore all claims are subject to the very broad arbitration provision in sections 1.1 and 1.4 of the CBA.
Out of curiosity, if the arbitration, let's say, for example, the fee provision in the collective bargaining agreement, it says something along these lines: everybody pays their own fees unless you're bringing a claim under a statute which authorizes fees. So I know that's not what it said, but just imagine it said that. Would the arbitrator have had authority to grant fees? So in other words, the arbitrator now has all the claims, including the ERISA claim. It turns out, in my hypothetical, the fee, no fee provision has a carve out for statutory fees under certain statutes. Would arbitrators have authority to give fees in that setting?
I think parties can limit the authority of arbitrators in this situation. That's a good question. I don't think that it would. And your question, Judge Sutton, is sort of similar to the Bayshore case that came out of this court a couple months ago. And that's in the commercial context, but this court realized that if there's a broad arbitration provision and all disputes have to go to the arbitration, then only the arbitrator is the one who could award relief and decide claims. But if there's a carve out, for example, that says the arbitrator can award fees, but a district court can, well, then yes, then the issue would go to the district court. Or
where, counselor, how does it play in that in fact the ERISA claims were not presented, that what the arbitrator ultimately took was the contractual breach only?
Thank you for bringing that up, Judge Ranch. I think that's an important point, and one that the district court really held the decision on. I think my first response to that is the arbitrator did decide the ERISA claims. By finding that there was a breach of the CBA, the district court found in its opinion that that means that there was a violation of ERISA. The ERISA claims were decided just as the CBA LMRA claim was decided based on that finding of a breach. But even if it wasn't, what the district court didn't do is explain how some ambiguity there could then confer authority back to the district court to decide the issue. As this court has found in cases such as Cleveland Paper Handlers back in the 80s, if there's an ambiguous arbitration award, well, that has to then go be decided by the arbitrator. And the parties here specifically agreed that if there was an unresolved ERISA issue, it can go back to the arbitrator, and plaintiffs specifically in their arbitration demand requested
ERISA. Well, if that's the case here, then how would the district court have the ability to determine your claim that the UAW waived its right to recover attorney's fees? If it has no jurisdiction and it's a question for the arbitrator, how can the district court make that determination?
It's really, the district court doesn't have the authority. Our position is to do anything.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Oh, I'm sorry. Our position is the district court doesn't have the authority to address this at all. But since the district court did so, regardless of the entity then who would be deciding the issue, that's the fee, pay your own fee provision, I call it, in section 4.4 is going to control, because as the district court found, all these claims spring from the CBA. The district court specifically found in its order compelling arbitration that the plaintiffs can't pick and choose the parts of the CBA that it wants to enforce. So therefore, if this was properly before the district court, that's pay your own fee provision is going to apply.
Well, then doesn't the question become, if the arbitrator did not take up the ERISA or the ERISA fees matter, then doesn't that have to go back to the arbitrator for the arbitrator to make those determinations?
Our position there is that the arbitrator has already made the decision, said you don't get any fees. And, you know.
Well, except that the arbitrator was ruling on the contractual breach issue, and there's no addressing in the arbitral decision statutory fees, right? I mean, the arbitrator does not address statutory fees or a statutory claim.
The arbitrator doesn't specifically do so, but I think part of the reason is that the district court found is the plaintiffs specifically elected not to assert those claims, at least in name only. So the district court, recognized, plaintiffs had all their claims compelled to arbitration, including their ERISA claims. So for tactical reasons, they do not put in their ERISA claim. They not go back to the arbitrator for the ERISA claim. Rather, they go back around to the district court after the arbitration, after they see what they get. And there's no authority cited by the district court or the plaintiffs that a party could essentially just do an end around from an order compelling their claims to arbitration simply by reserving one for the district court. And if they were unhappy with not getting the fees, the only course of action was to go to the district court, ask within three months an order vacating or partially modifying the award, and it didn't do so.
Why would that be the case if it was clear in Judge Sutton's analysis that there was a carve-out or that the arbitrator did not address those? I'm struggling with who has the power to resolve the issues that you raise. And it seems to me that if you are correct, that only the arbitrator can decide all these issues, I'm not seeing where the arbitrator has done that. And I'm wondering, why would there not be a remand to the arbitrator to address the ERISA claim and ERISA fees? You may get the very same result, but the district court, under your argument, does not have the power to give you that result, to say there's a waiver. So what happens?
Mr. Broski, answer that question, and then let's let Judge Rogers, he's...
No, that's fine.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I think the best way to put this, the ERISA claims, our position, they are bound by the CBA. There's nothing left to decide. Everything has been decided. The collective bargaining agreement is controlling with respect to the fees, and the claims themselves were in fact decided at the arbitration. There's just simply nothing left to remand back to the arbitrator.
Mr. Brodsky, I wanted to ask an orienting question, which I should have asked at the outset, but we sort of dive right into the merits of these issues. And I'm looking at your brief, which has 2A and B. Basically, your first issue is that this attorney's fee issue is not something for the district court, but rather for the arbitrator. And then your C, which is basically your next issue, is that attorney's fees were not awardable, I guess. And then the next one is that the request for fees amounted to an untimely challenge to the arbitral award. So if you divide it up into those three issues, are those independent issues such that if you win on any one of them, you win the whole case?
Yes, Judge. That's my.
And is there some sort of roadmap that we are required if we want to go through those issues, or can we jump to one of them? Is it sort of whichever one we want to look at first, or is there a logical progression that the law directs us to go through?
I think the first question is the authority question. Is that what, you know, what's the jurisdiction?
I'm having trouble hearing too.
Is the authority, is the jurisdiction? I think that is the fundamental question. If that gets resolved, as we're saying it gets resolved, then, you know, the arbitrator's award was the arbitrator's award. And that then.
But under your theory, we could rule against you on that theory and then go to the next theory. Correct. And say, we're going to do it, not have them do it. And when we do it, you don't get fees or too late challenge. Okay, that's basically my question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I see I have 20 seconds. So unless there's any other questions.
With respect to the timing issue, which I guess is the third one, where does that 3-month period come from?
It's a statute of limitations that's borrowed from the Federal Arbitration Act that's been applied to.
The Federal Arbitration Act doesn't borrow it from state law, or should it borrow it from state law?
I think it does. I'm sorry. I think that's right. From Michigan, it's three months after.
Yeah, it's either way you're saying, but technically, if we were to get to that issue, we would look at the Michigan 3 months as incorporated by the FAA. Is that your position now?
I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Wertheimer.
Wertheimer, your microphone is on mute.
I'm sorry, is that better?
Good.
Sorry. Good afternoon, judges. Let me begin with the district court's order, because counsel recites it as if the district court had said that any attorney fee or any other ERISA issue should be decided by the arbitrator. Far from that, the district court, first of all, defined the dispute as a vesting dispute, which it was. And then the district court said that dispute is subject to arbitration. Additionally, it specifically said any party may file a motion to reopen after the arbitration has concluded and made its orders, summary judgment orders, without prejudice. So it ordered the dispute arbitrated and defined the dispute as vesting. We went to the arbitrator. We stipulated on the record that the sole issue for the arbitrator would be, quote, contract interpretation and breach, end quote. We got a decision in our favor. We had, in the meantime, filed an appeal of the merits of that decision.
So counsel, could I just stop you there?
Sure.
What's hard for me to grasp is our court enforced the arbitration agreement, and at that point in time, enforced it by referring to any claims under the CBA or under ERISA. You know, at that point, you could do what you wished when you went to the arbitrator. If you didn't want to do the ERISA claim, good for you. But law of the case was that, you know, since you didn't appeal that order, the law of the case was that the arbitrator was going to resolve those issues. So if you decide for whatever reason to say to the arbitrator, just talk about the CBA vesting claim, we don't need anything more, you're free to do that. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but I think what you're not free to do is then say, we're now going to go back to district court and separately litigate ERISA, or more precisely, separately litigate ERISA fees. That I don't understand. That seems to ignore the law of the case.
Well, I remember, Judge, this court, that is this, your court, did not decide this case.
Lucky for you. Lucky for you. I mean, you're getting yardman relief that you wouldn't get anymore. So very good. You know, your tactics are remarkable.
That's correct. No, but what I mean is this court did not decide the issue of whether it was arbitrable.
No. The district court decided it.
That's correct.
An appeal, and you dropped the appeal.
That's right.
And if you're saying we now can decide whether the ERISA claim should have been part of the arbitral dispute, I'm happy to do that if you want. But it seems pretty obvious the clause covers an ERISA claim.
That which clause covers an ERISA claim?
The exclusive remedy clause.
Our position is that unlike the situation in Van Pamel, where this court on the merits said that these disputes are arbitrable, this case is different because the attorney fee issue is statutory and is dissimilar from the contract issue on attorney's fees. And that makes all the difference.
So explain to me how the ERISA claim was that different from the CBA claim.
The ERISA claim for attorney's fees.
No. I'm talking about the merits. How was the ERISA merits claim different?
The merits, they are the same. Okay. The merits, they are identical, and I'm not claiming otherwise. But what I am claiming is that when we were at the point after the arbitration decision where we had stipulated that the arbitrator would decide only the contract issue, not the ERISA issue, the district court had said, you can come back and reopen for any issues after the arbitration. And we decided at that point that the statutory issue of attorney's fees should go back to the district court as opposed to the arbitrator, who has no experience in deciding statutory issues, that we were correct in doing that. I would also point out that when we attempted to
how about this way of thinking about it? When the arbitrator gets the case back, the arbitrator would have had authority, had you said that was okay, to review the ERISA claim, the merits ERISA claim, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how is it that the CBA exclusive remedy provision covers CBA claims and ERISA claims, but the attorney's fees provision doesn't cover both as well? I don't get that.
Again, because this is the distinction that this court made in Van Pamel in ordering arbitration of a retiree benefit case. It made exactly this distinction in distinguishing between those cases which say that you can't waive a statutory claim unless it's specific. It said that's not a problem in the arbitration case because the contract claim, i.e., was the vesting issue a violation of ERISA, is the same as the statutory claim. That is not the same as the attorney fee claim. The attorney fee claim, we're basing it on 1132. And we thought the appropriate place to have that issue decided was a federal district court, who can now decide the 1132 issue if we move to reopen. Why would you send a federal statutory issue to an arbitrator? There's absolutely no good reason to do it.
It happens all the time.
Well,
it has not. Can I ask a question? Yes. I don't want to cut you off, Mr. Wertheimer.
No, that's okay.
You rely in your brief on the party's stipulation that the sole issues for the arbitrator would be contract interpretation and breach.
Correct.
I'm not sure if that's what you're relying on right now, but I am concerned about what the scope of that is. That appeared to be a limitation on the party's motions for the arbitrator to consider, but preserve the right to present further evidence to address issues unresolved by the arbitrator's decision on the motions, including factual disputes, ERISA, and so forth. Why isn't that latter preservation apply to the arbitrator and not to the court?
Well, we
it seems by its terms to reserve the power of the arbitrator to resolve issues that haven't been resolved by what we've done so far. It doesn't really say it goes to the court, does it?
It does not. And that issue remains silent.
But that sort of undermines the idea that all that was decided was a non-ERISA CBA kind of issue. The rest of that was contemplated to be also decided by the arbitrator, and they just didn't do it. But that didn't mean that it was the arbitrator's power to do if anybody was going to do it.
Well, we set it up for cross motions for summary judgment and said, you arbitrator, decide the contract and breach issue. And the arbitrator did that, period.
Did that mean that other issues were not arbitrable just because the cross motions for summary judgment were limited? You can have cross motions. I don't know about arbitration practice, but in the courts, you can have cross motions for summary judgment. Once they're resolved, you can still go to the court and resolve everything else. That seems to be what's preserved here by this language, rather than a stipulation that the issues are not appropriate for the arbitrator. You see what I'm asking?
I do, and I'm not saying, Judge, that the arbitrator might not have been able to decide that issue. But that's not the same thing as saying that somehow we lose because we made the decision that it was appropriate to go back and reopen the record as the court had specifically suggested so that the court could decide the issue of federal law, which is whether we're entitled to attorney's fees under 1132, an issue that the arbitrator had absolutely no expertise in. And it was not the reason that it was sent to the arbitrator in the first place. It was sent to the arbitrator in the first place because it was a contract, that there was a contract issue relating to vesting that arbitrators do decide and should decide, and that this court had held should decide.
Counselor,
in this case.
Is there anything in the wording of the stipulation that would show that both parties agreed that it would only be contractual review by the arbitrator and understood that the statutory provision would come back to the court?
No, I don't think the parties, in fact, did agree to that, and I would not represent that. I would represent that we stated on the record, we being the plaintiffs, stated on the record at the arbitration that we would not seek ERISA attorney fees at the arbitration, but rather would go back to the district court if we were successful, and we did it. And TRW made no objection to that, but they didn't agree to it. I would also point out that on damages, they forced us to go back to the district court. In other words, the district court decided every damage issue down to the penny because TRW would not agree to arbitrate the damage issues. And obviously there was jurisdiction for the district court to do that, and TRW has since paid the money, and it's not a subject of this appeal.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I'm understanding something you said earlier.
Yes.
When I look at 4.1, the exclusive remedy provision, are you making the point that it didn't cover ERISA claims? Are you making the point it couldn't cover ERISA claims, that they had no right to include statutory claims in that? Which point are you making?
I'm making the point that it does not constitute a waiver of the ERISA attorney fee claim.
Okay, but it is okay to have an exclusive remedy that incorporates statutory claims. In other words, that your only path to vindicating the statutory claims is through arbitration. That's
if
okay.
In this case,
it said so as to the ERISA cause of action, but not as to the ERISA fees. That's your position?
Yes, and this court said that the reason those issues were identical, and that's why it didn't constitute a waiver under Penn Plaza. And we go through all that in our brief. But yes, the Sixth Circuit, this court specifically held that there was no waiver there because the statutory issue and the contract issue were identical.
If I'd been in the company's shoes, I would have said if we're allowed to split things up like this, I would just as soon have the ERISA claim dealt with by the federal district court and apply the most recent federal case law about lifetime benefits, right? I mean, if you're allowed to split up, why can't they split it up in that direction?
It's not a matter of being allowed to split up. There is a substantive difference between an ERISA attorney fee claim based on 1132. The difference between that and a contract attorney fee provision that clearly we lose under, those are two different provisions. The vesting law between the contract and ERISA are identical. And that's why this court in Van Pamel said that despite Penn Plaza, there was no waiver here, or that there was a waiver. I'm sorry, that there was a waiver. That's the specific holding of this court in Van Pamel, which is how we're here in the first place. Otherwise, as you point out, we would have been in court and maybe we would have lost, but that's neither here nor there.
That goes to my earlier question about the division up of these issues. You seem to be arguing the merits of whether fees are properly awarded. And your opposing counsel purports to bring three independent issues. And one is that the issue you're talking about, but it's his second issue. And his first issue, broadly speaking, is that it's not the district court that should be making this decision. It's the arbitrator. And they say to support that, this has already been decided in this very, with respect to this very dispute by the previous decision that was not appealed, which sent all the issues to the arbitrator. How do you respond to that?
Well, the previous decision of this court was post-arbitration.
I'm not talking about of this court. I'm talking about of the district court that was not appealed, that you declined to appeal. Wasn't there a previous decision that said this would go to would not go to arbitration? Then it was
no, absolutely not. The only thing the district court said in its initial order was that we should arbitrate the dispute, which was relevant then, which was vesting, period. There was not yet any attorney fee dispute. We had not won. And it specifically said that parties could come back and reopen the record, which is exactly what we did when we ended up with a federal law claim that was not coterminous with the contract claim.
Okay, thank you.
I have one follow-up question. I'm still struggling with how we break this debate. Your opposing counsel says this was resolved below. The arbitrator decided these issues and we're done. You say the arbitrator did not decide those issues because they were withheld. And anyway, 1132 is a distinct remedy. So who has the power to decide between your two positions?
Well, I think this court, and I guess that brings me back to what I think is really the main point. This court—
But why does this court have the power? If it was all given to the arbitrator. I'm struggling with why this is not a question that has to be asked of the arbitrator.
Because the district court sent the dispute to arbitration at a point where there was no attorney fee dispute. The only dispute was vesting. And the district court specifically said, you can come back and reopen the record, which is exactly what we did after we won the dispute that we litigated in front of the arbitrator. And the district court at that point agreed, said that we didn't yet have an ERISA violation, so denied our attorney fee motion without prejudice, but ultimately granted the motion. Back to the reason that this court needs to decide it. I think this court in Van Pamel.
Mr. Wertheimer, you can finish up here, but you're past your time. So go, just finish in a sentence or two. Just want to make sure you knew you were past your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court in Van Pamel held that retirees have a duty to arbitrate. The Eighth Circuit had held otherwise. No other court has so held. What we're asking this court to do is now to hold that when you compel retirees to arbitrate, you are also not taking away their right to seek ERISA attorney fees. And finally, there are all kinds of ERISA attorney fees that we have that can't be disputed, i.e. we litigated damages. We litigated whether they had a right to put a reservation or rights clause in after we won the arbitration. Those claims clearly are in front of this court, as the district court recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Broski.
Just briefly, judges, thank you. To Mr. Wertheimer's last point, the reason that TRW was saying that the enforcement issues had to be resolved by the district court is because it's an enforcement issue. And as the district court acknowledged, TRW is saying that, hey, under the collective bargaining agreement, you're only responsible for 80 to 85% of the coverage rather than the 100% coverage that the arbitrator awarded. That was part of TRW's motion to partially vacate that went to this court, and this court agreed and adjusted the award accordingly. And that was only an issue that could be decided by the district court. Otherwise, we've been asking the arbitrator to reverse itself. And such enforcement issues are only the review of the district court.
You would say then, if there are fees related to enforcement by the plaintiff, then those could be awarded fees in the district court, just like some of your fees or some of your costs were taken back as beyond the scope of availability. So you would say then that some fees might be available for the enforcement proceedings.
I disagree, Judge. Enforcement proceedings of arbitration awards are governed in the labor context by the LMRA. There's no fee shifting provision in there, and this court has recognized that. Can't get fees for enforcing arbitration awards. Absent bad faith, which I don't think has even been alleged and certainly isn't the case.
I'm sorry, you keep cutting out at the end.
I'm sorry.
The end of your sentence.
Absent some showing of bad faith, which has not been alleged or shown here.
Okay, thank you.
And absent any questions, just I would ask that the district court's order of attorney fees be reversed, and the district court's order, to the extent it said that there's no pre-arbitration fees, stand. And thank you very much for your time.
All right, thanks to both of you. We appreciate your helpful briefs and arguments. The case will be submitted.